Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And you're listening to Start Writing.
And this is a discussion episode. And as I mentioned, Jay and I have been studying the work of Lisa Crone. And we did mention we would start doing some episodes on her work. And this will probably be how we're going to approach craft going forward. We'll look at a specific teacher on it and their approach in different styles. And there will definitely be points where they're going to disagree with each other. But I think part of it is you're going to find what works for you, right? So I'm a big fan of her work, and I'm really trying to incorporate a lot of her ideas into my writing. But this is her approach. Not everybody does it this way, and you may disagree with her on some things. So
this is Lisa Crone. That's C-R-O-N.
Yes.
And we read a book called Wired for Story.
Yes. Or
at least, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And you read her other one, too.
No, I haven't. I haven't started. I'm still in Wired for Story. So it's, I guess I kind of go slow at it.
Okay.
Take it bit by bit
because I like to really think about
it. It's super good.
And we can recommend it to you guys too. We're going to cover a lot of good stuff, but you should get her book. It's really good.
So I'll introduce her a little bit more in detail when we get into the discussion point. But first we have This Week in Critiques. So the last couple weeks, I've been reading one of Jim Butcher's one of his Fury books. And I've also been listening to the audio to Oathbanger by Brandon Sanderson.
Oh, cool.
And in it, there's a lot of minor characters in both stories. They're both big fantasy worlds, and we're following multiple characters. And several times during Butcher's book, I've gotten a little lost on the minor character. I know the minor character. I remember encountering him. I don't remember what their role is. I was like, why is he here? What's he doing?
Yeah, that's happened to me before. Right?
And so I was also at the same time going through Sanderson's book in the audio, and I noticed how he addressed that issue because it's a huge book, a lot of minor characters. And what I noticed is that early on in the chapter, if not the first action beat of these minor characters, within the first two or three, what he would do is the action beat would not necessarily be an emotional action beat, but rather an identifying action beat. And so the guy would sit down and maybe would say he folded his ardent robes into his lap and be like, that's an ardent. Oh, I know, that's an ardent now, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I wasn't getting that in Butcher's work, and so I couldn't sort out in some of these scenes what the minor characters' roles were. They'd been introduced appropriately, whatever role, profession they had, their reason for there, and it all made sense. But, you know, a week and a half later, you know, following multiple narratives, I watch movies and TV too, I would come back and be like, I don't remember. And Sanderson would address that for me and make sure, here's an action beat of this person doing something, usually involved some piece of clothing or a prop that clarified their role. You know, sometimes it would be a soldier touching his sword or drumming his fingers on a scabbard. And I wasn't getting that in Butcher's work. And so I just wanted to point out that particularly in dealing with a lot of minor characters, that's very helpful to a reader to use those identifying action beats to be like, in case you forgot what this guy did, because he hasn't been around for 30 chapters, here's a little hint.
Yeah, and I can see myself arguing that, oh, it's in there. They just got to read a little closer. But really, it's a usability issue.
Yeah.
If you can make it easy for your reader, they're going to enjoy the process a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm not going to stop and be like, okay, who is he? And flip back pages. I'm just going through the story,
yeah.
You know. Particularly in audio, like you don't go back and rewind. You just roll with audio, right? It's like a steamroller when you listen to an audiobook. So that was This Week in Critiques. That was just something that kind of jumped out at me. And as far as a reader, it was something that one storyteller was doing that really helped me. And I wish that the other storyteller had been doing it as well.
That's good.
Okay, so we don't have anything in Writing True this week. Jay's fault. Just kidding.
Next time.
We have mentioned that these are tricky, you know, because you never know when you pick up a book if you're gonna find one of those. So, Crone on writing. So we did a big series on setting, and so I decided that as we approach her work, this would be where we focus this week on her writing is we would talk about setting. And so what she talks about is a relevant setting, not irrelevant. A relevant setting. And her point is that it should be connected to character and story in some way. So her basic premise on stories is to use brain science and to look at how human brains work and think to approach story, as opposed to just saying, this is what's been done, this is what's successful, let's just keep doing it. Where she tries to break down each individual component and say, this is how the brain works. Does this component of a larger, successful, complex piece fit in with that brain science? And then she kind of sorts out from there. Hmm. So her point here is that we're wired to look for patterns in things and make those kind of connections to create these patterns, right? There's this episode of Glee where he sees the face of Jesus in a grilled cheese sandwich.
What?
Right? But this is based on the fact that people have seen it in potato chips and they've seen it in stains, because our brains are wired to see the pattern that makes up human faces. You can see faces in clouds. Our brain is looking for that type of pattern a lot because it identifies it as a very important piece of information, a human face, right? And so in identifying this, the two things you need to clarify up front to make sure that the readers can look for the patterns are the context, whether that be the whole story or just the chapter, and the goals of the character, whether it be the main character or the POV character in the chapter, because those two elements are what determine what patterns we are looking for, right? Now, that's us as a reader going through. We need that information to look for the right patterns. As a writer, you should have that information as you're writing your chapters, but then you want to make sure that you take that information and you write in patterns to be found. So we're going to look at some examples here, and we're going to talk about setting specifically, but you can kind of make this a grander piece, right? There needs to be patterns to feed that pattern-searching mind. So the example she gives is She throws together just pieces of the story. This isn't from a novel or anything. This is just a piece from her own work that she uses as an example. So this is what the writer knows, right? Mario is – so the main character is dating this girl named Mario. He's a big jerk, but since I'd rather die than be alone, I better do anything he wants me to, even if these stilettos are killing my feet, right? So this is what the author knows writing the chapter. So we're going to look at now – how she says, you know, how we're going to write setting in this and make it not just setting. It's not just in an imagery to fill out the scene, but rather it is going to be connecting to our character, her fears, and her goals. So that's what we want the setting to do, connecting to that character, revealing them deeper, moving the plot forward. It is not just imagery, according to Crone theory. It is a part that draws either the reader into the character more or pushes the plot forward. So this then becomes the story translation and meaning of those ideas. Oh, it's not Mario, it's Marco. Sorry, I said that wrong. So Marco and I walked into the courtyard. I saw my neighbor, Mabel, scurry into her apartment, quickly closing her door, lest one of her cats slip out. How many does she have? 8? 9? Yet she always looks so sad, as if she's afraid even the cats don't like her. There, but for the grace of God, I thought, grateful for the weight of Marco's arm around my shoulders, even if it means I have to walk faster to keep pace with him, which isn't easy in stilettos. And so, in the scene, the only piece of setting we get is it's a courtyard, and everything else is about her neighbor. And that's the setting that we see, right? The neighbor, she's got a bunch of cats, and she scurries in. And then, that setting then goes into her fears. Do the cats like her, not like her? Not relevant. What happens is that we see her fear of being alone and not liked manifest in the way she understands the setting around her. And then that rolls over into the poor choices she's making right now. Even though she knows Marco's a jerk and he's a terrible person, she's grateful that he's there, because then she's not the lonely lady with the cats, right? And so that is then the setting she sets for us. It's not a setting because it's visual, and impactful. It's the setting, because it reveals so much of her fears and her compromises in life.
And so let me just interpret this in my way of thinking of it. So I struggle with social anxiety. So sometimes when I'm in a public place, I get this tunnel vision where, like, I'm essentially trapped inside my head. And it really makes it so that I don't notice all sorts of other things going on around me. So I lose a lot of presence when I'm in that mode.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if I were writing myself as a character, I couldn't describe the room that I was in, because I'm not aware of the room that I'm in. I'm aware of the anxiety, and that's mostly it.
Mm.
Right? And so I feel like, now, let's say instead of me, you have an architect walk in, and all of a sudden they're noticing, I don't know, the curves or the angles or the way it's gilded. I don't know. But so your character is interpreting the scene.
Yeah.
And only the parts of the setting that matter to that character should come through in the narrative.
So you're rolling this into POV, but I think you're losing the context, goal, and depth aspect of this. So let's take your architect. Like, so let's pull out Mabel, and let's take the architect, and he walks into this room, right? Now, as the author, I can then say, okay, he's an architect. He's very interested in architecture. He's going to notice these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the joints, the height, the, you know, the way the space of the room and how they're managing the weight of the ceiling and everything. So he notices these things. And then I would say, okay, what of these elements can I then roll into his fears, his anxieties, his wants, right? Or driving the plot forward, a metaphor for what's happening. What of these can I then make bigger part of the story and have it be relevant to the story that's being told? So that's the crone element saying, let's not just have interesting setting, not just POV setting. What we need is relevant setting to the story.
So you're saying the height of the ceilings, if he notices that, then it needs to have some aspect on, you know, maybe there's a grandeur involved in what's going on. So it's setting a tone in that way, or like a majesty, or maybe it's the opposite, where it's like a cramped feeling.
Yeah.
So you're saying
So let's go with the cramped feeling, because I like that. So he goes in there, and they don't have vaulted ceilings. It's a ceiling that if you were 6'1", you'd be ducking just a little bit, right? and it makes him feel claustrophobic, right? And so maybe he has a little rant about the idiot who designed this place, and that rolls into how he feels about his boss and the work that's being rejected right now.
Okay.
He's like, it's great, and that idiot is just trying to make me build small rooms that make people feel claustrophobic, right? And so now it rolls into this plot of him dealing with his boss at work and having his creativity stifled, right? And so it's not just that he's an architect and he notices it, but then it rolls into that plot, his feelings, his deeper character.
So I guess in my first example, we had arrows going outward, like this is how the character is perceiving the world. We're flipping the arrows around now,
and right,
this is how the world is changing the mindset of the character.
So, or yeah, just causing him to reflect in and dwell on his issues and his problems and everything. So that's the relevant setting, not just saying what will my POV character notice based on his personality and traits and interests, but then saying of that, which can I then point back at him?
Mm.
Right. So the arrows, I guess, point to each other. And those are the ones that make it into the manuscript.
Okay. Yeah, cool. I like it.
So that's it. So we've got a couple more examples here that I was going to go over. So this was one from my writing group. And she said, when my parents would argue, I took refuge in my pink palace bedroom. There was Mardi Gras wallpaper on the walls, and I would try to find the jester as I lay there listening. And so I wanted to break this down into two points, right? As we're talking about relevant thing. So calling her bedroom a pink palace does tell us something about the character. And it could go one of two ways. Either she's a girly girl, or her mom is very girly and is forcing that on her because it's a child's bedroom. We don't have enough detail to know that. And I would probably say, if you're going to bring that detail up, go deeper into which aspect is relevant there. Mm-hmm. The Mardi Gras wallpaper doesn't. it's just imagery that doesn't give us deeper character knowledge, right? Or inspire any kind of reflection. And so my advice was take it out. You are wasting your words. You're building a setting that is just a setting. And we want something deeper.
Hmm. Well, so when I heard looking for the jester, it told me something about the character. Was that like that they were kind of silly or playful.
Hmm.
And it seemed to add like a boredom. And I don't know the larger story, so I don't know if those are accurate.
Right.
But that's what I read out of those details.
So, and again, I think if you want to keep it, you go deeper. You make it relevant. At this moment, it doesn't feel that relevant.
Right.
But you could make it relevant by going deeper. So the Pink Palace, to me, that feels immediately relevant because I feel like it's communicating something potent about one of those two papers.
Upbringing.
Yeah. But I think we need to go deeper into it to know what its relevant is. It's like, there's a piece of the puzzle. I cannot figure out where it goes. But the rush, so in her book, she talks about the dopamine rush, right? The dopamine rush we get is figuring out the puzzle. And if you don't give us a big enough piece, we can't see where it goes, right? And that's the lure of great fiction is that you get a big enough piece that you can fit it into the pieces you already have, but you still can't see the whole picture. You're like, I need another piece.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the real balance is trying to figure out how big a piece do I give you without giving you too much.
But probably err on the side of too much if you're not sure.
So, well, and that's what beta readers are for, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so that was my thoughts on that example. And then the third example is something we talked about, theme in setting, which is the Shawshank Redemption. And having that theme in setting is one thing that you can do that makes it relevant, right? And because we're talking theme here, I'm going to bring up Robert McKee. And so one of the things people don't like is didactic stories, right? This story will teach you this lesson. This is what it's about. And people tend to get rubbed the wrong way by that kind of story. Mm-hmm. And McKee's approach to this is to say, whenever you're dealing with a theme, you always explore the theme and the counter theme. And then it's no longer the theme being forced down your throats. It's saying, here's two sides of the coin. You can kind of pick which one you want. So, yeah, so theme in your setting is a good way to make it relevant, to build in those patterns that the brain is looking for.
Hmm. Man, and if you write both sides of the theme really well, then both teams will think your novel champions their cause.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny. I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast today. And he did an episode talking about the Colbert Report, and he talked about the problem with satire. And he says the reason Colbert was so popular is that the way he would approach the satire, both political sides thought he was on their side. Mm. he says that makes for great ratings, he says, but the problem is that no one walks away thinking there's a problem. Right? Everybody's just still entrenched on the sides that they're already on. Right? The Republicans are like, yeah, look at him skewer those Democrats. And the Democrats were like, yeah, look at him skewering those Republicans. Because of the way he presented the satire, you couldn't tell. Like Malcolm Gladwell, I think he was on the show two or three times. He even mentioned, he says, when you're there, he's like, I never knew if I was part of the joke or the brunt of it. You know, it's like, I didn't know where I was. And that's very much how the comedy was set up to appeal to both sides of the aisle on the political audience there.
Yeah, that's good. That's pretty cool.
So I don't know.
I love Colbert.
I don't know how we got on that tangent. But yeah, so that's a theme and setting there. Did you have anything else?
Did you cover?
Theme and setting? So the more specific example, the one thing I would point out is, so we have this one setting in the Shawshank Redemption. And we've mentioned in the episode we did on it that the show is about hope and hopelessness. And so there's one scene that's in a movie theater, and there is a shot where it's not them watching the movie or them at the side, so you see the screen and the audience. What you see is just the audience and the projector in back. And so it's just this dark, dark room with this projector light flickering there, and it literally looks like the light at the end of the tunnel. That's the setting, right? Very powerful lean on the idea of hope in that spot. It's a cliche metaphor, but the way they present it in that setting is just beautiful, because unless you're paying attention, you don't even realize they just did that. But yeah, and so that's an illustration of them putting the theme in the setting. And like I said, is your brain's looking for those patterns, and it realizes there's something there. So yeah, so that's everything I had.
Yeah, I think that was good.
So yeah, this ended up coming out a little bit shorter than some of our bigger discussion episodes. But I guess if I, to try and go any further into her work would branch into a too big of an episode. So it's kind of a tough juggle there. Yeah. But as always, we would love it if you would leave a review. It means so much to us. We need them. It'll help other people find the show. If you want, you can sign up for the newsletter, and we'll get you links to different things, whether if we reference YouTube clips and whatnot. Let us know what you think of the vocab episodes. I think there's only two out right now. So, yeah, you can kind of let us know. One thing I've been considering is maybe we would move poetry into the vocab episodes as opposed to being part of the grammar. I don't think we're set up for that today as we're recording some of those, but we'll try and work it in that way in the future. So, and thanks for listening.
It's time to start writing.
There you go.